Tim Goldstein, autistic adult, and your host for Life in a Neurotypical Universe, where we take a look at life from the perspective of an autistic adult. Welcome to Life in the Neurotypical Universe. Today we have with us Danny Combs, and Danny is one of the founders of TACT, and I'm going to let Danny explain more about what TACT is, other than it is really cool. I wish when I had gotten out of school I could go play at a place like that. Danny also is one of the co-founders of the Colorado Neurodiversity Chamber of Commerce. So, some pretty interesting things. So, Danny, tell us about yourself and how the heck did you get involved with all this neurodiversity stuff?
You know, it's a great question. My life certainly wasn't supposed to go this way. So, at least that's not what I thought when I was younger. So, it's kind of funny where you end up, where you think you're going, and where life kind of pulls you for sure. So, I find myself really, and you know, as I get older and the hair gets grayer, looking back and finding that the way the universe has worked out, it seems like it's just spat me exactly where I'm supposed to be, which is kind of an amazing place to find yourself, I think. But my great-grandfather and grandfather were tradesmen. My great-grandfather helped start a company called Grumman, which is now north of Grumman. My grandfather did that too, doing the Apollo missions. And then my dad was a general contractor, and I was the free labor that grew up with three generations above me doing all kinds of stuff, which I absolutely did not like. And when you're free labor and you're learning all these things, it just feels like work. So naturally you pick up a guitar and you run away to Nashville and you go do that. And that worked out really well. And, you know, I ended up finding myself with this beautiful baby boy named Dylan. That is the best thing that's ever happened to me. And, him and my other kids. And, it's funny that when I was younger, I never wanted to be a parent. I just wanted to be a musician. That was the whole thing. And that worked out really well. And then didn't know what to think about the whole parent thing, and turned out being a dad is my favorite part of myself, if that is such a thing. And just being there for my kids and making sure they have everything they need to be successful in life. And, you know, when my son was younger, it was the Facebook age where everybody started getting into Facebook and posting pictures and talking about how great their kid was and all the things that they were doing. And, Dylan was doing amazing things, but he wasn't doing the same things they were doing. And, for example, he was like six and a half before he said, "Hello, Dad, I love you." And so when he was just a couple years old, we started doing some testing to figure out what that was, and, came to find out that that was autism. And, must confess, I was kind of ignorant to what that meant. And I mean, I had new stereotypes and different things like that, but certainly not to the degree that I feel like I know it now. It's not really fair to judge yourself from where you are now years ago, but certainly was much more ignorant than I am now. Still ignorant, trying to figure it out, but you know, getting closer, right? 30. So I started, you know, taking him to all these different therapists and different things like they tell you you're supposed to do. And all I kept hearing were things that he had to change and do differently. And my son is amazing. He has so many strengths. And even though he couldn't yet say hello, Dad, he was able to somehow figure out all of these incredible things and was making things. And I was that dad that let my son play with scissors. And he would cut out things with cardboard and put them together. And it was just exceptional. He was really good at making things. And I figured kind of, again, that it was just, you know, fourth generation. This is what my family does. And it just must be. That's the family lineage, right? And tried to start finding ways to support him in that and couldn't find anything. Everything was so deficit-based. Everything was constantly what he needed to do better, how he needed to change or be different or somehow conform. And I didn't like that. And I happened to have a master's in education and knew that that doesn't jive with any of the educational philosophies that I personally adhere to. And it's especially not any of the educationalists that I really appreciate. And so I started developing the idea of a strengths-based traits program. And it started just simply as that. And then I had the chance to meet Dr. Temple Grandin and say, "Hey, I've got this idea." And it was one of those things when the idea popped in my head. And I'm sure you've had these moments where it's you're doing something and it just clicks and you get like the goosebumps on the back of your head and you just know. And then like you rush really fast to a piece of paper and try to rush, write it all down. And it was definitely one of those moments. And so I told Temple about what I was thinking. And she's like, "You need to put down your guitar and go do it." And I know you know Temple too, and when she tells you to do something, you do it.
She's pretty firm about what you're going to do.
Yeah, exactly. She still is with me. I love her to death. She's still a friend. She's become a friend. And, I just happened to know good people that helped get started, and good lawyers helped get the 501c3 set up, and, I shared the idea in April. By June, we had our incorporation in place. By October, we had received our official federal 501c3 super quick and started teaching classes right away. And honestly, we figured out a lot after running. I mean, we definitely hit the ground running where we didn't want to be one of those organizations that sat around, talking to each other all the time about what we're going to do. We wanted to actually do something rather than just sit around talking about it. And I don't know if that was the best way to do it, but it was the way that we did it. And it's taken off. So now we serve hundreds of kids every year. We have a 18,000 square foot facility, which you're kind enough to come visit and support us with some dust collections, fun stuff in our carpentry shop. We do carpentry, welding, electrical, cybersecurity, a whole bunch of auto mechanics, coding, instrument making, a variety of fun things. And it started with just me in the back of a 58 Chevy, because those were the things that I knew how to do that my grandparents and my dad taught me. And it's grown now. We have a full staff. And I think, at its core, what TACT is, to kind of long-windedly get to your question, is it's a place where kids are finally recognized and individuals are recognized for what they can do and who they can be. And I think it's a community where individuals come in and sadly for the first time they hear that they're actually good at something, and they get to experience being good at something for the first time because they've had to not have the opportunity to be themselves and do that for years. I mean, when a 30-year-old comes into your space and is building something and you see their parents tear up because they've never seen them be successful, it's pretty powerful. And then what makes us unique is we work with so many businesses. We have over 40 businesses that are proactively hiring our graduates and getting them placed into careers, because there's a difference between a job and a career. And we want our kids to have the genuine equality of opportunity to choose what jobs they want, what do they want their lives to be, and provide them with the tools to do that. Because so many, workforce development centers or advocate agencies or different things that are well-meaning and do amazing work, not to put them down in the slightest, that give the illusion of choice. Do you want to bag groceries, or do you want to work at a gas station or fold napkins or something that, if that's what somebody wants to do, man, God bless them, let's help them do it. But if somebody wants to do more, then they should have the opportunity to do the more. And we try to do that.
It's real interesting because a lot of what started out as autism at work, now most of the companies call it neurodiversity at work, even though it really still is autism at work.
Yeah.
A lot of that started in the tech world, of course. It was SAP, it was Microsoft, it was EY, DXC. And they continually push this whole superpowers thing that hire an autistic person and they're going to be 3,000% more productive coding stuff or doing QA work or whatever it is than an average individual. And I'm in the tech industry. I think I do pretty good, but I wouldn't say that I'm better than a neurotypical that does a really good job too. So to me, that A has kind of set us up as autistic individuals. And what I love is you're addressing really the opposite of what they're saying. They're saying, oh, they're going to be all great computer programmers. And the reality is I think it's just like any group. We take neurotypicals, we can divide it by any way we want to divide diversity. And mm-hmm. You're going to have some people that, yes, will be technical and work in the computer world and those fancy companies and such. And you're also going to have people that are cut out to be service workers. That's mm-hmm. what their abilities and capabilities are. Totally. And you really just fill that in between. As you say, the job services here in Colorado, of course, we call it DVR, Department of Vocational Rehabilitation. In other states, it's VOR, I think it's California's Vocational Occupational Rehabilitation. Every right. state has one. As you say, they don't know what to do with a neurodistinct individual that mm-hmm. has actually the capability to do career-style work.
Absolutely.
I love the concentration on the trades. My dad was a heavy duty diesel mechanic, so I grew up breaking things, putting things together, playing with the welders at 9 years old and all that stuff. And I actually opened a machine shop at one point. Dad wanted us all to have white collar jobs. So what do? I start a machine shop. And I loved it to death. It was wonderful. So I just find what you're doing is so amazing, because here in America, unfortunately, since late 70s, early 80s, we've done everything we can to decimate the trades.
That's the truth.
Try and hire a plumber and see what it costs you and find out how bad we decimated the trades, right? Or an electrician.
Yeah, it's the weirdest thing. And I know that I must confess I'm guilty of it too. I vividly remember, rejecting my family heritage of working in the trades. Like, my dad did very well. My grandpa, my grandfather, worked in the Apollo missions and did DSP and, retired at like 50 with his, moved to Florida. He did great. But there was still this notion that somehow, quote, white collar jobs were different. And I remember even being in music school and in college and thinking, I'm in the fine arts and, being classically trained and like very arrogantly having that an awareness of that. And I think it was rather ignorant at the time. And now, like, and more so as I grew up and matured too, seeing the value of the skilled trades. And it's kind of this full circle where it's like you accept who you are and you kind of come back to it. And it feels like what I've kind of done with it. And it's interesting how all of those things that are so powerful to pass on to your kids too, as like just a dad passing these things on to my kids, because I meet so many people my age now, the Gen Xers or the early millennials that their parents didn't teach them those things. And I just don't understand it. Like when you meet, a 40-year-old, 50-year-old, that's like, can you help me put up a ceiling fan? I don't get that, how they don't know how to do that.
Yeah, like, which end of a screwdriver to hold on to, right?
I don't understand how. And I remember, and even in college, like first getting into a dorm and, all the things that go with like coming into college and you get furniture and you're putting things together. And roommates not knowing that, I thought everybody knew how to change their own oil and fix everything. And even though I'm not a techie person, even the old computers, when you would buy a Gateway, that would show up, in a black and white Cal box or an early Dell, you still had to put it together. You know what I mean? Like there was still an element of that. It was separate pieces back then, not as much as it is today. And I think now seeing that and the opportunity that it provides, especially because there's such a deficit as we promoted college, debt, and all of these kids that are going. And if they want to go to college again, that's awesome. And, let them go do that. I think that's fantastic. But there's this amazing, viable, beautiful whole opportunity and career set that exists with very, very little debt, with training on the job, with employers that, value family. And not to say the colleges and stuff, no, they do too, but just like the overall perception I think is generally missed and it was considered less than somehow. But like when I'm seeing from our kids is all of these industries, and I think one of the reasons we've been so successful is our community and the construction and trades community has really jumped on board recognizing that, our community is fantastic and they've missed this giant, untapped resource of workers because of perception too of what autism is. And I think that, and neurodiversity in general, I think they don't understand that because of the way it's been articulated with media campaigns and people that are, funding it in certain ways or labeling it under different things because they can bill it. I think there, if we can set up a way of reframing it for people to genuinely understand that we're all unique. There's so much diversity and everything. I love the slide you gave for the Colorado Neurodiversity Chamber of Commerce, talking about the variety of different minds out there, everything from dyslexia to apraxia to OCD to ADHD to autism. When you start breaking it down like that, it was brilliant the way you presented that to showcase that we're all unique, and to think of it in that way, I think workforce would be better served. So would our community.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. Definitely. It's interesting that your dad and grandfather worked at Northrop Grumman. I did a presentation for Northrop Grumman probably three and a half weeks ago. And one of the discussions that we had, whenever I work with companies, I always do a 45-minute meeting ahead of time, because I don't believe in just giving a canned speech. You know, it's not like, okay, you're going to get the motivational speaker. It's going to be the same speech they gave at the last 27 companies they talked at. I want to understand, what's their goals? What are they trying to accomplish? What's the reason that they're doing this? And it was really interesting. They fully recognize that amongst their staff, which obviously is a huge amount of engineers and very, very skilled tradespeople, that they have a very large percentage of neurodistinct individuals who don't even know that they're neurodistinct. They just know that they like engineering things or putting together high-tech stuff or whatever it is. So I don't know, to me, funny how things go full circle. Here's your dad and grandfather, and now Northrop Grumman is actually trying to, I don't know, accept really, isn't it? Because they've been there accepting them, but they're trying to, I guess, showcase and appreciate the fact that they have people that are different, and that brings value to their company.
It so does. I often wonder, because, you know, when my great-grandfather was doing it and like helped start it, it started in Long Island. My family is originally from Long Island, and that's where it started. And he started as a mechanic, my great-grandfather, and it's like a tradesman building, you know, aircraft, because that was one of the things that they were starting to build. Never wanted to be the engineer. And then my grandfather, after he fought in Korea with the Air Force, and afterwards wanted to be the engineer. But where I'm going with that is their minds and their brains and the way that they actually thought of everything. I still think of it just that way. And I think it's so valuable and intact, because the way that they taught me, I can't say that any of my philosophies and teaching other than all those books you read in college and grad school. But at the core of it, I think when you're under pressure, you end up teaching the way that you were taught. And I think, you know, when TACT got going, it puts you in places as you're teaching all these different classes and getting set up where you end up defaulting to the way that you were raised. And I think that the way that my dad and grandfather and great-grandfather taught me, those are the same ways that I'm teaching our kids. And I think that's part of the reason it's been successful, is somehow their minds in working with the community, like you said, that was already there, were the same ones that taught me. And I think it's interesting how it's intrinsically come across and supported TACT. And I wonder if, like, my grandfather and great-grandfather were still here, what they would think when they saw that. Like, if they would be like, you're not doing anything original. You're just doing what I taught you. Like, that's how they would view it.
It really is. We've come full circle. That used to be how you would learn a job. You would go and somebody would hire you on. It's how I got into my first job, which was in the bicycle business. And I still can't remember whether I was 16 or 17. I don't know. I was one of those two. I basically had no skills. Yes, I knew how to work with tools and play with welders and build stuff and make fires and cut down trees and build wood bridges and all those kind of things. Right. But as far as actual real marketable skills, I really didn't have any. But they were willing to take me on because I at least had a minimal level of ability to do things with my hands. Right. And you work side by side. You had a real mechanic. And it's kind of funny. I would love to find the gentleman. His name was Mike Newbold, and Mike was their top mechanic. And kind of funny, when he actually left the shop, I worked with him for a couple of years, and he really is the one that trained me to be a bike mechanic. He actually came out and went to school at School of Mines, is where he left the business in upstate New York to come to. But same thing. How did I learn? I learned because this gentleman was willing to take the time and the effort to say, here, come on over here. Let me show you how to do this thing here. And it's a wonderful way to learn. The funny part is, to me at least, we try and make this distinction between being in the computer world and the tech world which I really don't program anymore. My job nowadays is a technical trainer. So that means that I tell people how to do what I don't do myself anymore. But, you know, I used to do quite a bit of programming in my career. And to me, whether it's programming stuff on a computer or whether it is building something, and as I said, I had a machine shop. I built a whole product line of stuff. And I've had plenty of other hobbies. I did radio controlled helicopters for 20 years or something, and on and on and on. To me, there's no difference in doing computer coding or building hands-on mechanical things other than the fact that the tools are different. The mental, the how you go about it, the how you have to think about it is the same. You start with, okay, what do I know? What's my base level of knowledge that I have at this point?
It's fair.
How can I approach this based upon what I already know? And you give it a try. And the reality is the first time it never works. It's scrap. I mean, if you're building physical stuff, I don't know how much stuff I've scrapped in my life. Plenty. The first one never works at all, ever.
Right.
And even using fancy, you know, high-end computer-controlled machines and all that stuff, the first one still never works. It's always scrap. And same thing with when you write code. The code never works. That's why you spend all your time debugging. You don't spend your time writing stuff. You spend your time fixing what doesn't work in your code. So to me, the mindset, how do you approach it is you try it. It doesn't work. You expect it to not work. That's not, you don't get crushed. You don't give up of, oh my God, it didn't work once. I'm done forever. I'm never going to try that again because it didn't work once. You just accept that, well, I've never done it before and you got to start somewhere. Hey, at least I got the first nail into the wood before I managed to nail it to the top of the bench.
I think that's so much deeper too, Tim, what you're saying, because in schools today, they don't allow that. And I think that's one of the things that's really wild in the sense that kids aren't allowed to fail. And failure is part of actually figuring out how things work, right? And I think so often, I mean, I don't want to say we let kids fail on purpose attack, but we set them up for success, but we're willing to accept when they do fail and help them overcome that and learn from that and keep growing. Where today there's all these, oh, I'll just, you know, put the grade on a curve or somehow lower the standards of what you needed to do so you still pass and move on. And these kids aren't getting that opportunity to fail and see what comes from that and then how to overcome that and the problem solving with that. And it can be so self-defeating for them to then like look at themselves when they get to the like out of school setting and they get on a job. And if you mess up, because you're going to, anybody that thinks that they're not going to mess up at the job, man, that's an illusion. And then overcome that, you know, and actually how to like, and two, like to actually have the, you know, function of looking at yourself and being like, I admit it, I messed that up, but I'm going to fix it. And saying that too, because even that ability goes a long way with employers, because of what we see a lot of times is kids, everybody messes up, like we just said, and you're supposed to, and you're supposed to grow from that. But there's always excuses that, you know, people come, oh, it was the tool was a defaulty tool, or the computer had this missing, or some other kind of excuse. We don't want our kids to do that. We want our kids to be trained to be brave enough to venture to try something, let it fail, learn from that, own it and accept it, and then be like, how can I do better next time?
Yeah, I put it in somewhat of a, I guess, philosophical manner, seeing as I guess I bill myself as the autistic philosopher of neurodiversity, that I say the road to success is littered with failures on both sides of the ditches behind you. And it's true, because as you say, you're not going to be successful. Okay, once in a while it happens. Okay, sometimes the stroke of lightning hits the first time. It works. Unfortunately, when that happens, normally the second time doesn't work because you have no clue why it worked the first time. But I agree with you 100%. Is the big challenge we have is we don't teach kids these days that failing isn't the end of the road. Failing is just a step on the way to being successful. because it wasn't that you failed. What failed was the thing you were trying to do. If you keep learning from that and progressing, you didn't fail. You just used the method of learning that's been used for eons. Try and build it, and when it doesn't work, figure out what went wrong and build it again. That isn't you failing. That's simply saying I didn't have the knowledge. I didn't have the skill. I might have had crappy tools, but with enough skill, I can even do a job with crappy tools. Nicer tools would be nicer, but.
It's so funny because, you know, from the music background, and I was very fortunate that music worked out. And we used to do this monthly picking circle, and it was so much fun. And I loved it. And it was every month, a bunch of us would get together and everybody would cook a meal, and it would rotate all of our houses, and you would invite friends. And it started with like a dozen of us, and then it grew to a whole bunch, and everybody would bring food. And then, you know, everybody would, you know, cook, you'd have a drink and a cup of coffee, whatever. And then you'd sit around, you know, the guitars come out, mandolins, violins, ukuleles, the whole shebang. And we would just trade songs. Everybody would start a song and you just jump in. You figure it out as you're going. It's not like there's a set rehearsal and you know what's happening. It's you're with this group of players. They're like, I'm going to play this song. This is, you know, what they would start. You figure it out and you go. And you would fail like crazy, but it was such a great tool. And there was this guy, his name was Royce Morgan. I don't know if you've heard of Royce Morgan, and a lot of people haven't, but he was the guitar player for the Everly Brothers and Johnny Cash, and like early Southern country, like Tennessee, Kentucky country, good country music. And a buddy of mine had bought this guitar and couldn't get it in tune and was trying to play it, and it played like garbage. I mean, to him, right? And he's just like, oh, this tool is so bad, right? His guitar. And Royce picks up this guitar and just wails. Now, mind you, you're playing with this guy that is played with all of these legends, like was a staple in the Grand Ole Opry. I mean, it's just as good can get, and makes this guitar just sing. And he just like passes it back to him and goes, son, there ain't nothing wrong with this guitar. And you're just like, oh, okay, sorry. it's just me. But I think that mindset where it's just like, teaching the kids too, that like, we're going to teach you these abilities, and, you know, does it matter if the drill that you have is a Makita versus DeWalt versus a Ryobi? We're going to teach you how to learn all of these skills and how to adapt and how to learn why certain things go the certain way they do. So you can figure out how to move forward with that rather than like, oh, it has to be this so you can achieve that. I don't know. I find that when we approach it with that mindset, our kids, they see it. It feels more real. And it feels maybe, I don't want to say old fashioned, but it seems more genuine. And I think that they appreciate that. So,
well, once upon a time, I worked in the general sporting goods business. Between the bike business and, I don't know, something else. And I was managing a quite large general sporting goods store. One of the things that we sold was golf clubs. And we also saw downhill skis and cross-country skis. And so the whole general sports. But you saw this particularly in downhill skis and golf clubs. The person would come in and they wanted to get better, so they'd buy a more expensive set of clubs. Mm-hmm. And obviously my job was to sell them the clubs. If that will make them feel good, then great. I'm going to sell them the clubs that they want to have. Yeah, exactly. But I'm just always thinking all the time as they're doing this, that you would become so much better if you were to just take the money you're spending on these clubs and go pay a pro to teach you how to swing the ones you have. And it's just, as you say, it wasn't the guitar that was a problem. It was that the player wasn't skilled enough to use the instrument well. Mm-hmm. And what I found as I've gotten skilled in the few things I have gotten skilled in, you really can't appreciate, I guess it goes beyond appreciate, you can't utilize and appreciate what you're paying for when you're getting those premium type items until you have the skill level that you can make the bottom end one work just fine anyways.
That's correct.
Otherwise, it just works the same as far as you know. You just got a fancy name and label on it. It's like wearing an Izod shirt. It's like, oh, I'm cool because it says Izod on it. I got DeWalt. Oh, I'm just like better than you are. Yeah. Yeah. But can you put a, you know, hole, you know, two holes in a row that are level on the wall? No. Yeah. It ain't DeWalt that made the difference.
Exactly. And I think if we can set our kids up with that mentality that they have the ability in themselves to actually do amazing things, and that it's not going to be driven off of what, you know, tools they have, that, as far as like brands and stuff, that they have amazing skills, and give them the opportunity to learn that. I think that's something that we really want to do. And I think at Tact, I mean, it's so hands-on based the way that you and I learned, where there isn't a moment you come to Tact where the kids don't have a tool in their hand, where they're not learning through doing. And there's like so much science behind that too. It's so weird when you think of the way that I think training and education is taught today versus the way that things change. And I mean, coming from an aerospace background, and like you were just talking about working with Grumman, you can look at the way education changed, and there's like a clear line in the sand in 57 when Sputnik like launched, right? Like we went from all of these families that were learning and teaching through doing to all of a sudden, and they were building amazing things. Like the early NASA guys, they had like eighth grade educations. That didn't matter. They figured out how to do incredible things. And then taking that, they see that, and all of a sudden it went from, okay, now we have to sit in pretty little rows and sit still and lean forward and like do all of these things in repetition. And I mean, it's like a clear line in the sand of where education started just nosediving. And you can also see where, you know, a lot of our community started really pushing back, where I feel like from what I've seen, and I'm ignorant still, so I'm still learning, and I would love to see your feedback too, but I feel like a lot of neurodistinct individuals do very well in those situations where they're learning and they're in, not in that educational setting of sitting still, being lectured, this auditory learning process that statistically only 11% of people actually learn from anyway. Nobody wins from that. Like all the that, you know, natural sense of universal design went completely out the window, and we started this conformity, we need to compete type philosophy. And I feel like it's starting to come back. And I think the trades are still a vessel that are still a window to the way that we used to train through doing, and offering opportunities for kids to learn that way and grown adults to learn that way. And it's not to say that everybody is going to be a tradesman. It's not. But the work efficacy that can be learned through that type of education exceeds just the skill trades. And it goes on to all kinds of different work functions, I think. And I can totally see what you're talking about in the correlation between the computer programming and working in a carpentry shop or a welding shop. I mean, the problem solving.
Problem solving is the exact same issue. The difference is I'm swapping out the tools I'm using. Other than that, how I have to think about it, how I have to recognize that, okay, take the best stab at it that you can and see what happens. And then stand back, reassess, where did it work? Where did it not work? Make changes, go at it again. And it doesn't matter whether it's building physical things or whether it's building computer code. It's the same process of continually solving problems.
Yeah. And I think when you set students up for that and you give them the freedom to make that, and you can see why teachers don't do that in most settings. I mean, if you've got 35 kids in a class and you're like, hey, go for it, take a stab, see how it goes. Oh my gosh, that is chaos, you know, to the nth degree. But if you can set up kids for smaller class sizes and have controlled chaos and kind of set them up where they're going to have those opportunities, but the outcome will be successful, I think it's a little bit more encouraging and has a better outcome for sure.
Well, I think another big problem in the education world, and I had the experience of working for one of the major school districts here in the Denver Metro as a consultant. And I was working in the assessments department doing analytics and data as my specialty in the IT world. So I was working on the assessments department, working on their analytics and data to create the reports that they needed for the different levels of government.
Okay.
And it's so obvious what is being measured. What is being measured is that kids can pass standardized tests. They're not being measured that they can solve a unique problem or that they can figure out what to do when the window of their car is stuck in the winter. They're not being taught any of those. Well, geez, let me think through this. What could I do? How could I make this work? What they're being taught is how to pass standardized tests, because that's what the reports that we send into the agencies that fund the schools want is, what are the grades? What are the passing percentages? Break them down by the different diversity groups. And unfortunately, we have that whole problem of, A, as you say, the classes are too big. If you've got 35 kids, if you can manage to avoid mayhem, you're probably a pretty good teacher, just if you can manage to avoid the place falling apart.
Yeah.
But you also have total pressure on you to not teach the kid something, but to teach him how to pass a test, because that's what the administration is pressuring you to do, is you better get all your kids to get a XYZ score on. I remember when my daughter was going to high school, and she's 36 now. So been a few years, but still, I don't think education's changed much in those number of years. And the things they would do to bribe the kids to show up on the day for the standardized test, it was ridiculous. They bribe the kids to show up.
Yeah.
So where are they making? They don't bribe them to do anything else. They don't bribe them to do anything else except show up for standardized tests.
So, you know, it's funny because I used to teach music, develop the music program they use in Nashville and in their music schools. I don't know if they still do, but at the time I had developed everything and it was really fantastic. And it was interesting because at that time there was new educational laws put in place federally. And the whole model was like, okay, you have to somehow grade these teachers like you're talking about, like how do they pass these tests? But if you're an arts teacher, how do you measure that? How do you quantify how well a 12th grader is playing violin? Are you measuring their tone, their intonation, their dynamics, their pitch? Like, what do you look at their posture? Music is very qualitative, right? You can listen to two different violinists or guitarists and have two different opinions of which one was better and which piece was better and how they did a certain section or a movement dip better, like how their expression was. And so what the government decided to do to grade these teachers was to base the music teachers off math scores and graduation rates. which makes no sense. And so all of these teachers, and then mind you, if the teachers failed 2 years in a row, they would lose tenure. So the tenure is a whole other topic, which we could go into, but let's say these high school music teachers that have been there for a while could then lose their position. Because, and they could have an outstanding music program, but they would lose their position because the kids couldn't pass calculus, or they would drop out or move to a different school and it would go against the school's graduation or some other capacity, make them look bad. And so all of these arts teachers started just dropping out like flies, and who can blame them? Because they were like, especially if you were going to go to like an inner city school or an underserved school, why would you put yourself in that position as that arts teacher to be penalized based upon all of the things that were already in play in that school culture that were going to make you look bad, right? Or make you somehow not have a job in a couple of years to feed your family. And then the arts just started nosediving. And when you look at anything like educationally or just culturally or society, like there's countless studies like talking about how the arts are better for people, and they help you become smarter. They help you learn more. They help you retain. They help you be more creative. All these different things. I look at it in the same way of the skilled trades, where systematically, like our society just hasn't valued these things. We can't measure it in the same way. Therefore, it's somehow treated differently. And I think it just doesn't make any sense. I mean, it doesn't correspond with any form of logic in my mind.
One thing that I would love to see from the arts, and I guess when I was younger, I used to do a bunch of art stuff. I actually won art awards. I don't think I was that good, but I somehow won the awards. And I actually almost joined the military, tried to join the military, playing revolutionary fife. I was lead fife, and I have a picture, Disability Inn used it in a little video I did for them. And it's me marching in a parade on July 4th, 1976, as playing revolutionary fife in a full, authentic Revolutionary War uniform. And I ended up failing because I have psoriasis. So as you know, and I don't know how many of our listeners, it's not uncommon for autistic individuals to have autoimmune diseases. There's a lot of comorbidity. So mine happens to be psoriasis. So fortunately, nothing at all that's going to be life-threatening, annoying, but not life-threatening by any means.
Yeah.
But after that, I did drop out of the arts, and I kind of went to the logical, hands-on, mechanical side of my life instead. But I ended up studying with a gentleman, I guess this now goes back to like 2015, 2016 range, which I would say one of the best vocal coaches in the world. It was Michael Jackson's vocal coach and other very well-known stars like that. So he was pretty good. He's pretty good.
And
and this is something, now this is how it ties into autism. There's the stereotype, and it happens to be somewhat true. It's not obviously every autistic. We all know every individual's an individual, whether they're autistic, whether they have ADHD, whether they're neurotypical, everybody's an individual. We'll just say that right up front. But it is fairly common for autistic individuals to be very, very monotone in their voice, and every word is exactly the same length, and they have flat affect, and they just come across, and they seem like they're not into it, and they're boring, and if they're not making eye contact, then you really think they're just disengaged. And Well, this gentleman, obviously coming from a background of being a world-class singing coach, taught speaking through using singing techniques. And what he told me, and one of, I took a lot of lessons with him, spent a fortune, and it was money extremely well spent. And what he said at one point was, I'm going to teach you to put emotional sounds into every word that you say. And he did it exactly the way that he teaches singers to put emotional sounds into every word that they say or that they sing. And when you think about it, who are the best people at transmitting emotion through their voice? Singers, right? You know? I think it would be so valuable to, you know, we hear about these different programs of the arts in theater and such, music for autistic individuals, but what they're never teaching is what I learned from this gentleman, and I term it as being emotional speaking. And what it comes down to is, when you think of it, what is it that makes a singer transmit emotion? Well, it's melody. They have melody in their voice. They're not monotone. And there's different lengths to the words. There's silence in there. There's all those pieces that are wrapped up into being a very good singer. But the funny part is most very good singers don't talk like they sing. When you hear them talk, they don't come across with that emotional ability that they obviously have. You just heard them. They have that ability, but they just go back to a dull, boring voice.
Regular speaking voice,
And there's no reason that they have to have a boring speaking voice. They could have just as dynamic a voice speaking as they do singing. And It's not something that is that hard to learn. You've been a music teacher. I mean, how hard is it to teach somebody to sing? They don't have to be like, so good that they're going to go sing the national anthem at a major league sport game. That's a hard song. I mean, that's a tough one. They don't have to be that good. They just have to get used to hearing themselves using different notes and, you know, moving through different pitches and getting used to the idea that that sounds normal. to have, you know, words not sound like every word is exactly the same and it's the same pace and it all moves at the same tone and it's all on one note. And if I had a piano, you could rip out 87 worth of the strings and I would sound exactly the same. I have found for me that has completely revolutionized my connection and interaction with people in general. Autistics don't give a rip. They don't care. They don't hear it. They don't even notice it's going on. So it doesn't matter with them. So it doesn't matter. I mean, it doesn't put them off. They could care less. And again, I'm generalizing some there, but, but with everybody else, you hear so often when people talk about having interacted with an autistic individual, they talk about it as saying it was like talking to somebody that was robotic, like talking to cardboard. There was no, they didn't get a human warmth coming back to them. And if they don't get the human warmth, then they don't, it's hard to embrace the person that you don't get this humanness coming back if you're an emotional kind of person, which is what most people tend to be.
It's interesting because I see your point and I'm with you. It's my experience. I mean, there's so many different things in the sense that we had, let's use TACT, for example. We serve, I think one of the things that makes TACT unique is we have the full spectrum of where everybody falls. So, and obviously autism isn't linear. It's so nice to hear people say that. There seems to be recognizing that now, even though if you're billing, right, it's still a number or a level.
Right. Instead, it's like a pile of pickup sticks and we all get a different handful.
How they managed to quantify a human being. But one of the things that's, it's really interesting to me, and I think that, you know, it's still, we're learning, but we have some individuals, and I'm so happy that we get to do this because we get to work with, you know, small class sizes, despite having, you know, hundreds of kids come through our program or young adults come through our program, is that we take the time to learn everybody. I know you're speaking in broad brushes, but we've got some kids that are remarkably articulate and have a lot of expression still that are, you know, where their autism comes out is their executive functioning piece. And then supporting them in that. And they've gotten further. And it's always so interesting to me where in their career, where that part that you're talking about, where they might have made it further in a career or something because of, you know, what somebody thinks of as likable or that interaction where, you know, especially in that initial interview set where the old fashioned way of sitting across and let me read you my resume and tell you how great I am. And I can make eye contact with you and like, you know, carry on this BS conversation that's not really going to lead. And then the whole interview is based upon that 10 minutes of likability. There are those that we find just like any neurotypical that have that, but then are having, you know, certain areas that we need to develop some, you know, some more success enablers to help them be successful. And then we've got some that are on the part of the spectrum where even to the point if they're using alternative forms of communication, like an iPad to communicate with us and what they're doing. And they will, you know, have people that have just ride that where they're falling off the spectrum off completely. And they will just absolutely crush it with tools. Like I had one kid and I use him as an example all the time. I did not know the FU emoji was a thing until this kid, because he would keep his phone and he would give you the FU emoji. But that kid could read a tape measure almost from the get-go and could cut and do all of these things and work on task for hours. And it was unbelievable in the sense that, you know, that communication piece wasn't there. And the same thing that you're talking about within that reciprocity and articulation and kind of in the dialogue sense back and forth. But his performance in portfolio was exceptional. And interviewing now, as we're getting all these kids jobs, almost alleviating it and taking out that entire aspect of it where it becomes, how good is somebody at something? And from a business perspective, do you want that? Like, what is it that's valuable at an employment setting? Is it the ability to sit at a water cooler and be like, man, the Denver Nuggets beat the Lakers last night. All right, now they're going to go on to take on Miami. Woohoo! Like, is that it? Or is it more valuable that you have an employee that might not be able to articulate those things or even care about them or want to talk about them or express them in any way, but man, they're outside in the shop and they're working their tail off and they're crushing it. And then that business is making more money. It's just, it's a different ebb and flow, right? And everybody has those different strengths. And it's neat, I think, in our sense, attacked with those relationships with those different businesses, to be able to have those relationships with business, because you know which businesses value what. And if you can set those kids up for success by helping them be like, okay, here's a list of employers. And kind of like we were talking about earlier, that genuine equality of opportunity, it's your choice. Do you want to work with all of these different employers that we know inherently value these certain strengths? And it's interesting how when those kids are put in that situation, all of a sudden things that were perceived as deficit, especially when it comes to language and communication, all of a sudden seem to either be no longer as upfront or present, or somehow no longer noticed as much by the people around them.
As you that are regular listeners of Life in the Neurotypical Universe, and as you who are new listeners will soon find out, we often have conversations that go on far longer than normal podcasts do. And in this case, Danny and I had a lot more we wanted to talk about. One of the things that we're going to cover in the next episode is also going to be talking about his involvement in the creation of the Colorado Neurodiversity Chamber of Commerce. It's going to be quite innovative. Please join us in the next episode as we continue our chat with Danny and talking about TACT, and as we start introducing and talk a little bit about the Neurodiversity Chamber of Commerce of Colorado. We'll see you there. Thanks. Na, na, na. We hope that you've enjoyed another episode of Life in the Neurotypical Universe. Please, if you enjoyed this, share it with your friends. Go take their phone and subscribe them. Hey, they will help us all out. If you want to know more about neurodiversity or have any questions for me, you can reach me at my website, timgoldstein.com, where I'll be more than glad to help you as best I can to navigate through the neurotypical universe.